Hello. Today in the Loopcast, I have Dr. Mark Jurgensmeyer, and we're discussing what I called on Twitter the God and Violence trilogy. So we're discussing Terror in the Mind of God, God at War, When God Stops Fighting. And then also Professor Jurgensmeyer was quick to point out this is actually a quadrilogy. There's also the book Global Rebellion, which I think is actually the first one. The reason that I start on Terror in the Mind of God is it is probably one of the most influential books. So I think for somebody like me that went to graduate school for the study of religion and the study of politics, that was the most formative book that I had read. And when, as most of you kind of know my backstory, when I transitioned out of that and into computer security, it was one of the few books that I kept and kept up with. And last year, Professor Jurgensmeyer published God at War and now When God Stops Fighting. So that's what the conversation is going to be about today. So please welcome my guest, Professor Jurgensmeyer. How's it going?
Oh, it's going just great. Thank you so much for inviting me. I look forward to the conversation.
Of course, of course. I want to maybe start off with a very sort of basic question and almost kind of like an origins question. But when it comes to your interest in the intersection of religion and violence, what was the starting point? Was it just a pure academic interest, or you were sort of observing world events? What is, you know, that seed? When did it get created? When did it get planted, so to speak?
No, it's a perfectly good question, because nobody's born a terrorism expert. You know, I see myself on TV and it says terrorism expert under my name. And I say, how did that happen? because I've always been interested in religion and politics. I grew up in a family that was very religious, but my father was also a local politician. And then I went to seminary and studied religion, and then I went to international affairs and then political science at Berkeley. And so religion and politics is what I've studied. In most cases in India, because right after graduate school, I went to India for a couple of years, fell in love with it, and have been going back to India on a regular basis. And most of my earlier works have been about India, religion and politics in new religious movements. My dissertation was on a religion of untouchables, which was also a political movement. And I also wrote a book on Gandhi. I worked with Gandhians, and I'm a pacifist. And so you're saying, how did a Gandhian pacifist get interested in religious violence? Well, that's exactly the kind of person who does, because it seems such an anomaly to what is proper about human experience. To suddenly see the world charged with a kind of almost cosmic battle between good and evil that then allows one to participate in a kind of destructive way that one never would in normal society, and certainly wouldn't in the normal kind of dictates of religion. So, I mean, it's easy to understand why bad people do bad things. It's harder to understand why good people do bad things. People who otherwise are on a kind of religious trajectory or see the world in religious terms that ultimately lead towards peace, why would they do such hideous things in relationship with religion? I always said in the name of religion, but it's not, what I found is it's not that simple. It's not that religion drives people, because I use the term religious violence. It doesn't mean religion causes violence. I mean, you can talk about religious music, you don't think religion causes music. It just means it's associated with it in some way. So how did this happen? Well, as I said, I lived in India for a period of time, and the area of India that's kind of my home is the Punjab, northern India, where Sikhs live. I taught there at Punjab University. And then in the 1980s, when this horrible spiral of violence began between young Sikh men and the Indian government, just a hideous confrontation that led to the deaths of so many young Sikhs in an all-out kind of slaughter by the militant police in the Punjab, and also by acts of terrorism by the Sikh activists, kidnapping people and stopping buses that were burning people alive, hijacking planes, blowing planes up, like the horrible act on Air India, a plane leaving Canada heading for Delhi. And was likely an act of violence related to this movement in the 1980s. And I wanted to know why. I knew a lot about the Punjab. I knew a lot about Jat Sikhs and how they depended on agriculture, and many of them felt somewhat marginalized by India's economic policies. But this had to be something else. It had to be something more. So I went back to India, actually, after the killing of Sanjanal Singh Bindrawali, who was the leader of the movement in 1984, in something called Indira Gandhi calls Operation Blue Star. And they attacked where he was sequented in the Golden Temple. And in doing so, destroyed much of the parts of the Golden Temple, the occult duck building adjacent to this beautiful gold sheath temple in the midst of a sacred pond. But 1,000 pilgrims were also killed in that act, and Sikhs all over the world were incensed. And then later that year, her own bodyguards, who were Sikhs and who had not been militants before, but they were so angered by this, they turned on her and riddled her full of bullets, and she lay dying in the lovely garden between her home and her office. And then thousands of Sikhs were killed in reprisal, and the movement continued until the 1990s. So how did this happen? And I went there to try to understand what the dynamics of this were, to try to get inside the minds, the mindset of people who took on this battle. And what I found was a fascinating thing, an imagined war, a great battle, in which, to a large extent, the secular state was the enemy, and not other Hindus, not other either Sikhs or Hindus or Muslims or Christians, but the secular state saw it imperiled their sense of nationhood, their sense of identity, their kaumiyat in Punjabi or Hindi terms, their community nationhood, trying to find a way to translate that phrase. It was that sense that their very existential being as a community was under threat. And so these kind of struggles, these kind of imagined wars, these, I call them cosmic wars, because they're greater than mortal wars. They're on a metaphysical level. They are really battles, existential battles over one's very existence, and not just oneself, but one's community and one's culture, one's faith. And so they saw all of that under peril, or imagined it under peril, because these wars are, like all wars, to some extent, imagined wars. We are kind of wrapped up into these great notions of battle. And then for a time, that just kind of takes over everything and justifies everything. And those who participated don't feel that they are criminals any more than soldiers in a righteous war feel that they are doing something evil. Quite the opposite. They think they're battling for good. So the same thing can be said by these Sikh activists. That was the first study. And then I took this project on the road. I began to looking at other instances in other parts, like the Middle East, of Muslim activists, and Sri Lanka for Buddhist activists, and discovered in every religious traditions. And of course, we've seen this increasingly. And then with Christian militia, even at that time, there were instances of the Christian militia, but in the recent years, combined with politics and then kind of the insurrection of January 6th, you saw a lot of symbols of religiosity and the feeling that this was not just an ordinary battle, a mortal battle. This was a cosmic war. It was a battle for the soul of America. And of course, they imagined this to be a white, heterosexual, evangelical Protestant male-oriented America, which never really existed in that way, but in the imagination of those people who felt aggrieved, that this was what was being lost and this is what needed to be fought for. So that was the beginning, and in some ways it still is, my search to try to understand why these events are happening, what religion has to do with it. And why are they happening now, at this particular moment of late modernity and the rise of globalization? And of course, the very fact that this is during the rise of globalization when nationalism is under siege everywhere is a clue to that answer. And so that was part of the first book on this project on religious nationalism, called The New Cold War, and then reissued in a different title, Global, more recently, and I updated it, actually rewrote the whole book, on global rebellion. And then the one focusing specifically on instances of religious violence in every religious tradition, and that's Terror in the Mind of God, the global rise of religious violence. And then more recently, followed by a book focusing on that idea of cosmic war, the idea of war in general, and what religion has to do with it, in a book called God and War. And then just a few weeks ago, publication of the latest book, When God Stops Fighting, the result of a five-year project that I've been engaged in, with support by a Swedish foundation associated with Uppsala University, to look closely at three cases. ISIS, the most recent case of a movement that has kind of come to an end, although just 2 weeks ago, they managed to attack a prison in eastern Syria and liberate 200 people. And of course, just today, I'm talking probably before this is airing, and you have the time all, I should probably say recently, although it's today as we record this, President Biden announced that the killing of al-Qureshi, the leader of ISIS who replaced al-Baghdadi, in an attack in western Syria near Idlib. So ISIS is still very much alive, but yet it's not alive in the same way. It doesn't control vast swaths of territory. So to try to understand how that changed, and how that changed from the inside, that is, in all these cases, I go and talk with people. Go and talk with people who were supporters of the movement. Go and I've gone and talked with people who are actually militants in ISIS and now in prison. And to try to get their understanding of what happened and what's going to happen now. Then many of the fringe people have fallen away. Many of the true believers are still true believers, but they're realistic enough that know that, well, right now the movement's not thriving the same way it was before, so they're going to bide their time and wait until the movement rises again, which it might. We may not be rid of ISIS. So the second movement I looked at was Khalistan, the movement I began my whole project with, this movement in Punjab of young Sikh activists. And now after some 30 years, how do people who are involved in the movement look back on it? How did it come to an end and how have things changed? It's a very interesting story. And I was able to talk with some of the people couldn't imagine talking with 30 years ago, leaders of the movement who were fugitives from the law, and now they're managed to come back and they've gone through whatever legal proceedings the Indian government had against them. And now they're living in a farmhouse in near the town of Patala. In one case, a guy by the name of Zafarwal, and others are comfortably living in suburbs in Chandigarh. I mean, it's amazing. And yet they still have a sense of the righteousness of the cause, that they were glad they participated, even though to me, in many ways, it seems like it was a tragic encounter. But how did it end? I talked with the policeman who's regarded as the father of anti-terrorism, counter-terrorism in India, who claimed that he did it. It was because of the strong militant measures of putting down the movement. And there's something to that. But when talking with people in the movement, I discovered it was already really destroyed from within. They lost the confidence of the villagers. There was infighting, their factionalism. And in almost all of these movements, it's really, they last only so long. I mean, you can last only so long with the kind of heady notion that you're part of some great visionary battle before things begin to decay. And you doubt the leadership, and you see the leaders as being self-serving and corrupt, and you get involved in petty disputes, and the movement begins to unravel, and then the villagers who had supported you no longer support you. And the third movement I looked at was the moral movement in the Philippines. In some ways, the most successful of transition, because they have actually succeeded in creating an autonomous state of Bangsamoro in Mindanao. The very people I talked with over the years in doing this project now have become leaders of this new state, which is really quite impressive that they were able to make this transition. They were quite militant. You know, that was as militant a movement as any other in terms of carrying out acts of violence and attacks on the Philippine government. But now in the transition, they've accepted that there is another way of achieving their goals. So each of these movements have ended in a different way, which was useful, although there are some commonalities that thread throughout all of them. That is the eternal decay within the movement, dissension. But perhaps the most important, at least from the Philippine experience, is hope. The sense that there is an alternative. There are other ways of doing it. There are other ways of achieving the objectives. And this is where the governments can play a very important role, rather than simply trying to destroy these movements or fighting fire with fire, the way a lot of counterterrorists put it. If they saw these movements as people who really do want a different life, and they do want a different world, and even though the rhetoric sometimes may be strident, their actions are very destructive, yet they do have aims and goals that can be dealt with and can be synthesized into some kind of alternative that doesn't involve violence and for which the participants can find a new life and a new future. So that's what the books have been about. And I'm willing to pick up any of these threads you would like and continue the conversation.
So something that stood out to me was the idea of religion as practiced at the temple, at the masjid or whatever, versus the idea of religiosity. And the reason I want to pick up that thread is that something in one of your presentations, you had mentioned Timothy McVeigh. And this is just obviously there's going to be a lot more examples, but with Timothy McVeigh, it struck me that he's not a very religious man in a traditional sense.
Who's that?
Timothy McVeigh.
Oh, yeah.
So he's...
none of these people are. I mean, Osama bin Laden he delivered fatwas, but the guy had no religious credentials whatsoever. I mean, he was trained in business. He claimed he was an engineer. He wasn't. His family was in engineering, but he had no religious credentials at all. His number two man, Zawahiri, was a medical doctor. Leader of Hamas was a medical doctor. Now, it's true. There was Sheikh Yassin, who is the leader of Hamas, the titular leader of Hamas, but all of the other people had no real religious credentials. So often these movements are not... they're not led by the clergy and people who are kind of dominated by religion, by people for whom religion is an attribute of a movement. So it's more complicated than that. And it also feeds into that what I've said earlier about these not being movements that are caused by religion. I wrote a paper once on, is religion the problem? And my answer was, well, no, it's not the problem, but it's problematic. That is, there are all kinds of other social and political things that happen. In the case of ISIS, for example, clearly the grievances of Sunni Arabs feeling left out of the political life in both Syria and Iraq, where Shia governments are in control. Alawites in Syria are kind of Shia. And then the Shia in Iraq are very much in control. And so the Sunni Arabs feel that they're really second-class citizens. They're left out. And so this kind of apocalyptic movement of al-Baghdadi, even though posed in religious terms, says, we've got to conquer our evil enemy, the heretics of the Shia, and put it all in religious terms, it very quickly is translated into social terms. Yeah, we need to empower our people. We need to have a voice. We need to have somebody who speaks for us. And almost all of the people I talk with, including some of the most true believers in prison, they when they're talking about the aspirations of ISIS and what it meant to them, they began with talking about Sunni empowerment and the fact that Shia treated them like dirt. One guy said, we have something to fear with about ISIS. He says, you don't know whether they'll kill you or not, but we know the Shia will. They just didn't trust them at all. So, and they would talk about the Iraq government as the Shia government, not, the secular government or the Iraq government. So very clearly for them, support for ISIS meant support for a Sunnistan, something that would support Sunni Arabs against the Shia Arabs that control the country. And then, of course, you have the Kurds, the different ethnic group. Well, they're also Sunnis, but a different ethnic group who are trying to, control the the excesses of the ISIS and Sunni Muslims. They become very important, actually, in helping to defeat ISIS. Alas, the Americans, abandoned them at the end because of Trump's deal with Turkey, which is just a real tragedy. That's part of the reason why my Qureshi was able to take such a stronghold in Idlib. Idlib is kind of an uncontrollable city anyway. It's a rebel held, but there's a large jihadi presence, and Turkey supposedly is control of that area, but they're not really in. The Kurds have been, who are the most effective fighting force against ISIS, have been to some extent weakened by this deal with Turkey that Trump capriciously made over the telephone. I'm not sure he even gave much thought to it. There's no indication he really discussed it with anybody who knew anything about the situation. He just wanted to please Erdogan. And anyway, that's a whole other story. But the point is that these are movements for Sunni empowerment and not simply for religion.
So then when we get to the point of fusing religion and war, or religion and violence, what makes that fusion kind of unique? And kind of thinking in the mode of like a poli-sci student, we tend to categorize, violence tends to have these distinct categories. Here's a war, or here's terrorism, here's counterinsurgency. But when we happen upon the topic of religion and war, what makes that fusion unique? How does that, set the topic apart from other sort of conceptions of organized violence?
Well, first of all, religion means different things. And many scholars in religious studies want to abandon the use of the term because it's so fuzzy and uncertain. I remember as a graduate student, when I was first in India doing research in the villages, and I asked people what their religion was, my interpreters turned to me and said, "What do you mean by religion?" I said, "Well, religion." And they said, "Well, we don't have any word. We don't have any word, single word for religion. We have qom, which means a community, large community. We have pant, which is a fellowship around some kind of religious leader. We have dharm, which means religious law. And we have mazhab, which means belief. What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, all of those things, religion." No, they didn't have any single term. You can. And I've seen this in the Punjab, people who are a part of the qom or, of Sikhism. They wear the Sikh, keep the Sikh signs of the beard and the turban. But their guru is a Muslim peer. And they go to their pant, their fellowship is a Muslim peer. And their dharm, their beliefs are really fundamentally Hindu. religion doesn't work the same way in other parts of the world as it does in the European and American West. But having said that, what often we think of as religion is religious ideas or religious symbols. And they can be very important for a community that's defined by religion, which often is what we're really talking about. People like Timothy McVeigh, who didn't seem to have a religious bone in his body, But, you know, he blew up the Oklahoma City Federal Building. If you read the Turner Diaries, which is his Bible, you see it was for Christendom. It was for Christian culture. It was for the Christian tradition that he thought was being eroded. And Anders Breivik, who picked up a theme from Timothy McVeigh in Norway and then attacked a youth camp in Norway, killing a great number of people, had issued a manifesto with the same idea that he was, again, he didn't go to church. He did one part of church religion, but he thought he was protecting Christendom. He didn't want Muslims taking over the country. And he titled his manifesto at a date that was resonant with the siege at the gates of Vienna centuries earlier, that it kept the Ottoman Empire from taking over Central Europe. And he thought that's what he was doing again. He was doing in Norway. He was keeping multiculturalism from taking over Norway, which he thought would lead to the corrosion of Christian culture. And all those people who were parading in January 6th and who were, you know, wanted to protect the American values, which to them was white Christian and evangelical Protestant Christian at that, you know, male-centered heterosexual values, are really describing a certain kind of religious identity and not religious belief or religious symbols. So many of these movements, they're religious in that sense. That is, they're part of identity, social identity. But sometimes they're religious in the symbolic sense, when they acquire, particularly in acquiring images of cosmic war. I'm really fascinated with that, because I end up writing a whole book about it. Because in every religious tradition, every movement of religious violence or religious related terrorism, I see these images in the background, images of great battle, of great warfare, which are often lifted directly from the scripture. They're the great wars in Deuteronomy, that in the Hebrew Bible, that fuel some of the more violent activists in Judaism and Israel, who are killing Palestinians, followers of Meir Kahane. But they're also the references to war in the Quran, not as many as there are in the Hebrew Bible, but many references, which then fuel the jihad of many Muslim activists. And Christians often are motivated by both by Deuteronomy and by the images of the book of Revelation that talks about, you know, cataclysmic violence at the end of times, a great confrontation, and just imagines that we're moving that direction, and that precedes the rapture, in which then the true souls will be saved in this vision of millenary and evangelical Protestantism. So every religious tradition, even Buddhism, the great wars of the Mahavamsa in the Sri Lankan chronicles talk about warfare. So every religious tradition has these images that it can be appropriated for thinking in terms of grand war that then are applied to the current battles in which they're social group, often again defined by religion, is engaged. So religion plays several kinds of roles, both in identity and providing a symbolic resource. Because if you're involved in a cosmic war, then, you know, you never lose, because this is God's battle. I talked with the leader of Hamas, both Sheikh Yassin and also Dr. Rantisi. Dr. Rantisi is more the practical head of the movement. And I said to Dr. Rantisi, you know, you people can't possibly win. There'd be suicide, bombing. It can terrify people, but it's not going to change the power of the Israeli army. It's not going to sway anyone to the Palestinian side. And he kind of looked at me as if he was talking to a small child. He said, well, not in my lifetime, perhaps, and maybe not in my children's lifetime, or even in my children's children's lifetime, but in my children's 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 lifetime, we might succeed. He said, because we cannot lose. This is God's war. Well, if you think you're fighting God's war, then temporary battles, you can lose without really shedding much of a tear, because that's just a temporary skirmish in what you think is going to be a grand scenario that will ultimately lead to victory. It also means your own death may just be a transitory thing, particularly if you have a strong belief in afterlife in which you would be rewarded. So the images of cosmic war and religious-based violence can be potent. That's why I say religion may not be the problem, but it often is problematic because it adds a whole new dimension of absolutism that's very hard to negotiate with. And once you are in that imagined bubble, it's hard to get out of. Although what I found in this last book on When God Stops Fighting, people do fall out of it. People, just like falling in love, you fall out of love. Well, you can fall into cosmic war and you can fall out of it when things began to be fall apart. I talked with one lady in a refugee camp in Kurdistan, in northern Iraq. And I said, when did you realize that it was over and that this great battle of ISIS really was not going to happen? And she said, when everything started falling apart. And I think what she meant by that, the disorganization that came at the last minutes, where people were scrambling for their own protection, where people were throwing off their uniforms if they had them and trying to escape any way they could, where they were turning on each other, blaming each other for the weakness in resisting the forces that were really much stronger than they. And she saw that as just that kind of chaos as a certain sign that everything was falling apart. So cosmic war ends. Maybe not soon enough for many of us, but it does end.
That's interesting. I mean, it almost seems like, religion is its own kind of alternate reality, and it's kind of changing the nature of violence to this idea of there is no time scale. It's rooted in symbols. But I mean, pulling back a bit, how does that change the nature of violence then? When you begin to bring in this alternate reality of religion, of religiosity, of apocalyptic thinking, right? It's an apocalypse, but it can't be fitted or formed to any sort of human understanding of time.
Yeah, I'm glad you used the term alternate reality, because that's the phrase I talk about a lot in my book, God at War, as seeing war as an alternative reality and religion as an alternative reality. And the fusion of the two in cosmic war is a very important intellectual construct indeed. So the question is, when you're in that alternative reality, how do you get out of it?
I mean, you can tackle it any which way. I mean, I think that the idea of being in that alternate reality and trying to get out is kind of the main question nowadays. I think in our previous shows on ISIS, on QAnon, that question constantly comes up. Like, how do you, somebody who is very much a participant in a cosmic war or thinking or, is waging a cosmic war, how do you take them from that apocalyptic mindset and then work them out of that respective movement?
Yeah, and QAnon is a good example. I mean, it fits the pattern of these other movements I've been talking about perfectly. If I were redoing the book, if I were redoing Terror in the Mind of God, I would probably begin with QAnon. And January 6th is an example of kind of cosmic war at work in an American context. And you may say, oh, well, these people weren't all that religious. Well, what makes you think that the Al-Qaeda activists were all that religious, or Timothy McVeigh was all that religious? They battled for a cause that they thought was just, but they're wrapped in this image of, a cosmic battle that just was totally engaging. And if you ever talk with somebody who is totally immersed in this worldview or seen video clips, of, which are really quite frequent, YouTube clips of people who go off in rants about, you know, how the election was stolen and how there's a deep state and how there's evil creatures out to get us, and just remarkably imaginative kind of conspiracy theories. And you wonder, how can anybody believe that? But once you're in that worldview and reinforced by all those images, and of course, today's media kind of control and the way in which one's information can be siloed, and how YouTube and Facebook and Twitter all kind of they provide you with more of the stuff that you seem to like. Because their goal, of course, is to get you to stay on their social media. And so you just keep on getting bombarded by more and more of this stuff. And you assume, well, that this is the way the world is, because all the stuff that you're reading now and everything you get reinforces these crazy views of the world. It's just really a deeply disturbing kind of development in modern communications. But it's no different than what happens even when people are not bombarded by social media. If they're just people in their village start talking with them and everybody in the village starts talking. One of the young men in India who joined Khalistan told me that he was trying to explain why he joined the movement. And it was just kind of floundering for excuses, some explanation. And finally just said, well, you know, everybody was doing it. It's just what we did. And so if all of your peers kind of are thinking the same way and they're reinforcing your beliefs, it doesn't have to be social media. It could just be the community around you that reinforces a particular image, and then you're off and running. You're in that bubble of cosmic war. And for him, it all began to decay when things literally fell apart. And people were being killed and the villagers didn't support him, and there's all this fighting. And you can see that it really was a fragile and corrupt construct of the imagination. And something of that, I think, is already beginning to happen among followers of QAnon, many of whom now become quite disaffected with Donald Trump and his use of devices of money raising for his own purpose and his hypocrisy in his statements. And so they're beginning to fall away from him. They're beginning to quarrel with each other. We'll see whether that leads to a kind of unraveling of the worldview. But I think it has to happen to a large extent from inside, because of those of us who are outside can't really penetrate that bubble, and anything we say is going to just bounce off. It's going to be regarded as, oh, you're just saying the words of the evil anime. You know, you were kind of you've been. They think we've been brainwashed because it's counter to their vision of the world, and so therefore they have to have some explanation for it. So you can't argue with people who are immersed in this particular worldview. You can love them, particularly if they're members of your own family or friends. You can, and what I try to do in cases where some of my own family members are supporters of some of these visions, is simply talk about other things, family things, just to try to get away from politics and never argue with their political position. I'd say, well, you know, I don't agree with you, but let's not discuss it. I want to know how your children are doing. I want to know how your health is going. And I want to know what you've been doing with your life in other ways that allow you to go through the day from time to time to try to bring people back into a different kind of reality. I think that's unfortunately about the best we can do. And it's only within the movement itself that serious rupture in the worldview can emerge. And it will, invariably will. QAnon will not last forever. It will dissipate just as these other extraordinary visions of cosmic war have dissipated. We just have to be patient.
It's kind of fascinating to me that it almost seems that most cosmic wars are kind of doomed to fail, right? I can't even think of, like, off the top of my head, I can't even think of a situation where an extremist movement has won or has declared victory or has been able to, the problem is defining victory. If there is no time scale, there is, you know, everything is rooted in symbols, then what is victory? But let's just return to the question, you know, our cosmic war is kind of doomed to fail, that we, you know, yeah, that's, let's start there.
Yeah, I think in an extreme form. I mean, there is certainly, you saw the case of the Philippines that I just talked about, and the troubles in Ireland, between the Protestants and the Catholics, which again was not really a religious battle. It was between two different ethnic groups in confrontation over the same territory. But after the Good Friday Agreement, there were still some of the worst violence happened shortly after it, but it didn't deter people. They were on a mission for peace at that point. And since then, they're still struggling with that peace, but there is a peace, and they've managed to build a life together again. So these are examples of kind of the modification of cosmic war. It may very well still be in people's minds. They may very well believe much of this, but as long as they're not trying to kill somebody, then you can tolerate it. I mean, you don't really care what kind of wacky thing your neighbor believes, as long as they're not trying to kill you, right? I mean, so that's, in some cases, the most we can hope for. And God at War, a book with that kind of realization that war is going to always be with us. It's a temple of a human imagination. It's very strong, very potent. And it is in part because it is just the counter of ordinary reality, which is based on civil interaction and then trying to modify difference and come to agreement. And of course, war is just the opposite, where you hate your enemy and you try to kill them. And so it becomes the stuff of computer games and of novels and of movies. And you think about a good number of the most successful movies are about war. Almost all of the computer games, at least the one that track young teenage boys, are about warfare, or battle of one sort or the other. Your urban warfare in the ghetto, or great battle like some of the more recent computer games. And so it's, they're very strong. There's something there about the human imagination is drawn to war. And that I don't think that will leave. But I think what can happen is the realization that it's not for proper society. It's for our imaginations. And it can be, as it is, a very important part of religion, a very important part of culture, a part of literature. And even the acted out games we play are somewhat warfare, whether it's soccer or football or whatever. But if it's relegated to symbolic and kind of metaphorical activities and doesn't involve physical violence, we're actually killing somebody or trying to kill them, then we can tolerate. In fact, we rather like it. You know, it's part of the amusement of life, and it allows us to go on. And maybe because it's this was the insight of Sigmund Freud many years ago, is the symbolic violence can mitigate against real violence, and that may or may not be true. The number of studies trying to prove or disprove it, but nonetheless, to some extent, it's a good replacement for the real violence that erupts with actual war, or the carrying out of visions of cosmic war. And maybe that's the most we can hope for.
So it's something that I kind of struggle to understand. So even if, you know, even if we take QAnon and they fall apart, but at the same time, there is evidence to suggest that they are trying to sort of acquire political power. So like thematically, when a group engages in cosmic war, and part of that cosmic war is creating political power, right? So participating in elections, school board, and you know, assigning, you know, running for school boards, running for house seats, whatever. Like, how do we understand people who consider themselves to be engaged in the cosmic war and have don't necessarily engage in violence, but want to accrue political power? Because it seems like, well, I guess ISIS tried to build a state, and so that's a form of political power. But I guess we've never seen it happen in a democracy, not in the way that sort of Q adherents kind of have been approaching it.
Yeah, and this movement towards populist autocracy is a development all over the world right now. It's one of the unhappy features of anti-globalization, a reaction to globalization, but it also lies in parallel with it. I mean, there are at the same time movements for greater understanding and acceptance of multiculturalism and a sense of global citizenship, at the same time that there's these tribalistic, extremist and autocratic movements often fueled with religion. That's a part of the political dynamics of our time. And it's a dangerous one and we should be concerned about it. But in most cases, I'd say that carefully, certainly not all, in most cases, it doesn't end up in actual violence against people. It certainly restricts their freedom. It restricts their freedom of speech. It leads to a kind of sham democracy of cordoning off the ability of many people to participate in the public life, which is a terrible tragedy, especially for a country like ours, who's so proud of its democratic tradition. It's just it's a horrible thing to see this kind of strong development of autocratic populism. And yet, I guess what I'm trying to say that it's not quite the same as visions of cosmic war. For one thing, political governing requires some work, and it requires a certain degree of just day-to-day concern about how the electric grid is working and how, you know, how the streets are going to be claimed when it's full of snow, and all of these very practical considerations. It's interesting that when Hamas came to power in Palestine, at least for a time, there was much less violent extremism. It was almost as if the leaders were now too busy just with the details of trying to administer the country. I'm not saying that they did it well, and I certainly think that their extremist ideology, the case of Hamas, it often has gotten in the way of them being able to rule effectively. But they've tried to rule, and the Islamic State was a state. Mosul, for the people I talked with who had lived there, and I talked with quite a few of them in refugee camps right outside of the city. Most of the Sunni Arabs with whom I talked thought that, at least at the first years, that the city was being run fairly well. For one thing, ISIS employed some of the old administrators and leaders that were not allowed to be in power under the Shia government. And they knew what they were doing. They knew how to administer, and they brought in a lot of their compatriots and guys I talked with who were Sunnis were really pleased. And finally, they had jobs, you know, and things were going well. And I said, "Well, when did they stop going well?" I said, "Well, when ISIS began getting so paranoid, it began turning on its own people, and it began seeing enemies within, you know, the Sunni Arab community and begin turning on us." And they gave examples, including to the guys I was talking with, about how one guy had thrown in jail for several months because he was smoking cigarettes. And the other guy was found out to be a former policeman, and they were, found out he ended up in a soccer field in the middle of the night, and he realized that they were killing people, that they would just round them up to be killed, and he managed to escape. So, I mean, they very quickly discovered the brutality of ISIS. But the point is that at least for a time, when ISIS was trying to govern, it was trying to govern. And that has a kind of moderating effect. And this is in no way to say that these movements, including the supporters of QAnon, are now trying to seek political power, that they are going to do it well, or that they are going to be in any way the kind of champions of democracy and champions of civil discourse and the things we like in political leaders. Quite the opposite. But it's unlikely that they will be trying to kill people, and nor to attack the government, especially if they are now in charge of the government. You know what I mean? So we'll see. I mean, we're facing some very tough times with elections, midterm, and then the presidential elections in a couple of years. And they could make a dramatic difference. And then we would be having a quite different conversation, I suspect.
So would we automatically consider a group of people who are waging cosmic war to reject the state or destroy it? Because I'm really sorry, I keep returning to QAnon, because they're just trying to, you know, think about QAnon is so baffling, because they seem to reject this, they wage cosmic war, they reject the deep state or the state in general, but at the same time are trying to gain power and co-opt within it, co-opt the state. So
yeah.
So then,
some of the leaders are, you know, most strident rhetoric are elected officials.
Exactly. So when we begin to construct a framework of individuals who wage cosmic war, where do we place the state? Are they trying to just do away with the state and recreate their own sort of paradise, co-opt the state? How do we understand the relationship of somebody who wages cosmic war and the state? You know, the state as a set of laws, processes, however you want to define it.
Well, its relationship is different in different contexts, but in most cases, at least initially, it seemed to be the enemy, because the secular state is at the enemy of movements like this that are outlawed and are taking acts of violence in order to try to destroy them. But on the same hand, as you say, in many cases, the goal is to replace the state, to take it over and to become the state. In the case of the Philippines, or the case of Ireland, they were successful and really very, very successful in developing a governmental structure that really is quite good and democratic and fair. And so it's possible that the outcome of these movements can be positive ones. But there are also cases where they've tried to create a very, you know, in the case of the Iranian revolution, that they've created a theocracy. Well, you know, Iran is a state, it's a government. Not everybody in the country is happy with it, but it's persisted and at least is keeping all the basic functions of government going. And from time to time, it's been fairly progressive in the kind of and accommodations it makes to the wider society and to international cooperation, as in the nuclear peace deal that was for a while forged with European nations and the United States. So there's an example of what happens when cosmic war wins, that is, when it takes over the state. It has to rule and may carry, even decades later, a lot of the characteristics of that cosmic war, the religious language, the fervor, the kind of sense of in and out and we and they, and yet at the same time, it has to learn to govern.
Interesting. So I kind of want to switch footing and look at when God stops fighting. And in the book, you sort of propose this a few ideas about how cosmic wars end. Could we go through, if you don't mind, the conditions in which cosmic wars end, and which one, you know, how can we as people in the space of like de-radicalization and you know, people who are aiming to bring extremists out, how could we create those conditions? You know, how is there, you know, can somebody from the outside create those conditions, or is it something that we have to kind of allow to happen on its own naturally?
Well, both. I talk about conditions internal to the movements, things, changes that then causes a collapse of this vision of cosmic war and a loss of faith in the movement. And we mentioned some of those in our conversation: infighting, a struggle, a sense of the movement is corrupt, that they've lost the vision of original vision that they had that inspired them. And all of these are things that happen within the movement and have to happen within the movement. There's almost nothing you can do from the outside. I know there are efforts at counterterrorism that try to argue with people, let's say, that jihadis are not believing in a true Islam, and they bring in a mullah who has good religious credentials to explain that their ideas of jihad are not properly Muslim ideas. And they just laugh at it because they think this is a guy who's, you know, just, you know, a fake, that he's been brought in to say these things. And it's not just unconvincing. It really makes them even more convinced of the veracity of their point of view. So you can't argue with them, and you can't argue out of them. So those the internal sense of collapse of the vision and the feeling that the movement has gone awry and cannot be sustained. Those things happen to be happen. That has to be the experience of those within the movement. At the same time, there are forces outside that make a huge difference also. And the people within the movement are keenly aware of the response of authorities to them. And one of the most common responses of authorities is to, as I've heard it put in government circles, you got to fight fire with fire. And if you want to, you know, you have to cut off the head of the serpent if you want to kill it. Well, sometimes it's a hydra and it's a many-headed serpent, and you actually have made things worse. And that's often the case with heavy-handed militant acts. This certainly, I think, was the mistake of the British, and the British have accepted that in the situation in Ireland. When they came hit too strong in trying to hit against the protests of the Catholics in Northern Ireland. And this really created martyrs. And then it created a sense of, well, we have to fight. We have to, you know, the British, they're not going to listen to us. Peaceful protest doesn't work. We have to fight fire with fire. That's the problem. That fighting fire with fire often just produces more fire. And so I think that's the danger of strong militant action from the outside or police action. On the other hand, there's a need for clarity to show the limitations of acceptable action. So no response, if a movement starts killing people or takes on a belligerent attitude, and if there's no response from the authorities and they're just allowed to do it, well, it's pretty much the case in Syria and Iraq, in part because these are pretty unstable states, both of them, and they don't have the kind of authoritarian control in the areas of Western Iraq and Eastern Syria that are dominated by Sunni Arabs. And so they were allowed, these movements were allowed to grow. And that was a big mistake from the authorities also. You know, people have to, yeah, you can protest, you can say that you want to, but you start killing people, you've gone over the line. And that has to be made perfectly clear from the outset and responded to strongly. So there's a kind of balance between the amount of force that's appropriate and the amount of force that really is counterproductive. And often it's counterproductive. Of course, Mrs. Gandhi and the Operation Blue Star discovered that. And when she was persuaded by her generals that all they had to do was invade the Golden Temple and kill Bindranwale and everything would be fine. And that turned out to be a disaster that, of course, ended her own life. And then there's something else that the authorities can provide, and that's hope. And by that I mean to give a sense of life outside of the struggle. And this is important in some cases for very personal reasons, because many of the people who joined these movements, like say the Khalistani movement, they were 16 years old when they joined it. This is also true of the people I talked with in who began the struggle as jihadis in Iraq. They were just kids. And this is all they know. And now they're in their, some cases, they're almost 30. And fighting is all they can do. That's all they've done. And so if they're not fighting, what are they gonna do? So to give a vision of what they can do. In the Philippines, they have these retraining camps where they try to, teach people, car repair and plumbing and, accounting and useful things that they can then have to go out in the world and actually do things with, but also a hopeful alternatives in terms of the vision of the movement, which is why in the Philippines it was so important to keep alive the idea of a Bangsamoro, an autonomous Muslim state in Mindanao that would be supported by the government. They could enter into a negotiated pact, which they did. And that was very important in the transition moments. And when the government sat on that idea for several years and didn't do anything about it, that's where some of the violence began to crop up again, like the horrible attack on the city of Mirari in North Dakota, Bato City in Mindanao. I went to that city and it was devastated because they used American air power just to destroy the city to save it, because the city had been taken over by ISIS supported people. They were Mindanao Muslim militants, but they claimed to be affiliated with ISIS. I mean, their movements like this, like Boko Haram claims to be affiliated with ISIS. Their movements all over the world that claim to be affiliated with ISIS, and the affiliation is really very tenuous. But because of this, there is because they took over the city, the control of the city, the Philippine government, with support of American air power, was ruthless in their destruction. And that, I think, for a time created other problems, especially because the negotiated agreement for Bangsamoro had not been implemented. But Duterte, I think, was smart enough to realize that, or at least his advisors told him, that was part of the problem. And so not too long after, the Philippine government did proclaim this negotiated settlement. It authorized its implementation. And now it is a reality and a functioning reality. So if there was something like that, for the Sunnis in Syria and Iraq, that would make a huge difference. Or if they would simply change the constitution in a way that would allow greater representation and control over some share of the oil money of all of them. There are very practical grievances that Sunnis have in Iraq, and also different grievances that Sunnis have in Syria. A response to that in some way, I think, would greatly undercut the resurgence of ISIS, which we see right now, because they do give an alternative. They give an alternative to fighting. They show that there are other ways to achieve these ends. So the governments do have a very positive role to play, not in undermining the movements, but showing individuals in the movements that there are other options, and that there's ways of achieving their goals that don't involve violence.
I think that's really interesting, because I think in our conversations about Q, that is with people who are like our friend Shannon, who is very much in conversation with extremists to bring them out, our friend Sarah, and it just seems like the hardest thing the hardest kind of leap is creating that alternate vision and sort of that hope. Because I think, especially with Q, it's like one of the most heartbreaking things is going on Reddit and kind of reading about people who struggle with Q, family members who are believers in QAnon. And it's just like, it just takes so much energy to convey hope or to create an alternate vision. Like, I think in one thread, it was like, they basically had to shut off the internet and be like, like start conversing with them normally instead of like within the framework of conspiracy and cosmic struggle. But
that's very important. I mean, they have to know you don't agree with them, but just avoiding arguing with them, because that's not an argument you're going to win.
Exactly. So my question is, you know, on the individual level, so not at the state level, but on the individual person-to-person level, how do we get better at conveying alternate visions of life and conveying hope, especially, you know, when dealing with, you know, QAnon believers, when, you know, in a more extreme interpretation, like Christian identity believers or neo-Nazis, how do we, on that individual level, sort of, you know, become better peacemakers and better sort of, I guess, enders a cosmic war, but that's not really a good phrase.
It can take a lot of time and energy, and usually you're not going to be willing to invest that time and energy unless it's a member of the family to whom you're quite close, or a friend to whom you have once been quite close, and that's understandable. But then the challenge is with that individual, if you're willing to take the time and energy to try to get them to explain what it is behind their concerns, that is to try to understand what really upsets them. You know, I mean, they'll say, "Oh, it's because, you know, deep state is out to, you know, okay. Well, how does that affect you? What is it about that you find troubling?" And maybe in that way, get some indication of aspects of their own life that they feel is threatened, and then you are able to get a better sense of what animates them, and a better sense of how, whether it is possible for you to, you know, provide some kind of solace or some kind of alternative way of thinking that meets those concerns. But you have to take the time to do that, and I have to admit it's challenging, and I count myself among it. I have my own relatives who are, you know, a cousin who is very much wrapped up in this rhetoric, and I try to be as reasonable with her as possible. And I have to admit it's difficult, and I have to admit since I'm securely some distance from her, I often just don't take the trouble to have to discuss with her or meet with her. My own brother, who's dead now, but who for a long time was very close to this way of thinking, and I would try very hard to understand him, because how could we both be in the same family and come out of the same womb and have such different perspectives on the world? So it's a challenge. It's one worth taking up, but I have to admit it's draining. It's difficult, and it may not be consequential. We may not find anything that we can do about it. But on the other hand, we might, and I guess that's why it's worth the effort.
No, it definitely is. It's just a theme that keeps coming up, like across, you know, every show we've done on ISIS or, you know, white supremacy, that's the big theme that seems to be coming up. It's not a problem that you can just, you know, kill your way through or shoot your way through or arrest your way through. It is kind of this very deep rooted it kind of, the more that we kind of peel the onion, so-called onion, it just gets worse and worse. But yeah, it's very interesting that you're kind of saying the same thing that a lot of our other guests have. It's really this kind of long-term engagement, and kind of it requires a lot of energy and a lot of time, but hopefully the end product is, you know, getting somebody out of that way of thinking. So I think we've kind of hit on all the topics that I wanted to discuss. As kind of our tradition, we always give the guest the last word. So the ability to leave us with something to think about, or a research thread to look at, or just parting words for us to kind of chew on and to kind of really just get us thinking, so to speak.
Yeah, well, the latest two books are God at War and When God Stops Fighting, which are kind of follow-ups on Terror in the Mind of God, the book that you mentioned earlier. All of attempts that I'm trying to do what I'm still trying to do, and that is make sense of the world around me. You know, I'm a social scientist, but for me, social science has always been just a journey of discovery, of trying to make sense of those things that seem senseless, those things that seem to, you know, prick at you, that just don't fit into the kind of reasonable world that you would like to have. And that's what got me on this journey of trying to understand religious. That's how an old Gandhian pacifist like myself got engaged in the study of religious violence, to try to understand why and why now. And I'm still asking those questions. They're still good questions to ask. I'm not sure I've found out everything, but I've tried. And I'm so happy I can share it with people in the books that I've written and in discussions like this today. And I thank you for the conversation.
Of course. So with that, thank you so much. That was my guest, Mark Juergensmeyer, Professor Juergensmeyer, the author of Terror in the Mind of God, God at War, and When God Stops Fighting. Go. All three books are absolutely worth your while if you're in the space of studying extremism, whether it's religious or secular. Just amazing, amazing work. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.